Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:18 PM, that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is April 5th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I'm going to post a report by Ray Dalio in here today. It just came through, and he has got some very interesting charts in there about income inequality and the benefits that have accrued to the top 40% versus the lower 60% of wage earners. But I'd like to just frame that within the context of manufacturing jobs. What I find particularly interesting about the rhetoric and the discussions that have been going on in both academic and market circles for quite some time is to discount the importance of manufacturing jobs. When we look at the USA's number of people who were employed in manufacturing, it ranged mostly above 17 million between about 1965 and approximately 2000. And there was ebbs and flows. That's what you expect from manufacturing. When times are good, manufacturing jobs expand. When times are bad, factories close. They have to leave people go. So they are one of the most economically sensitive sectors. In response to that uncertainty, generally speaking, manufacturing jobs tend to pay better. And that's one of the most important factors in why they had been such an integral part of the economy for decades. Because manufacturing is one of the primary ways where ill-educated or less educated people have an opportunity to work and to achieve a standard of living that approximates the middle classes. And without manufacturing, there is no other source of income that can allow people that are less well trained or educated to approximate the same level of income. So a lot of jobs that have been created in the last 30 years have been in the services sector. But when we talk about services, what people tend to think of as services as people working in Google, working as in computer programming or web design, but what it in fact means is people working as waiters, waitresses, wholesale workers, people working in warehouses. That's where a lot of the job growth has been. Personal trainers, hair stylists, nail stylists, dog groomers, all of these service jobs have exploded in popularity, but none of them come even close to approximating the kind of wage that you get from a manufacturing job. I think there are two extremely important points that are standing out from this chart. The first is something obviously happened in 2000. That resulted in the USA losing 6 million manufacturing jobs in the space between the recession in 2000 and the bottom in 2009. And there was a small interval between about 2003 and about 2006, which is represented by the housing bubble. And we saw that manufacturing stabilized, and then during the credit crisis it collapsed. And in the space of a decade where we have had extraordinary monetary accommodation, the pace of manufacturing recovery has done approximately half of the previous decline. And this doesn't even look remotely close to the kind of response that manufacturing would classically have had to a recovery from a recession. If you look back to the 1960s and 70s, or even into the 1980s, we had very clear upswings in terms of manufacturing jobs. Whereas the fact that you've basically been able to add on approximately 1.4 million manufacturing jobs in the last decade. Well, considering that we get new hires coming in at approximately 200,000 a month, that tells us that the return of manufacturing is paltry compared to other areas of the economy. What it also is contributing to is the inequality, because the kinds of jobs that are being created are generally not particularly high paying, and those that where there is a job shortage are in highly specialized tasks that it requires a great deal of education and connections to attain. So that's creating this chasm in terms of the better off and the less well off, or the haves and the have-nots. But this is not purely a US phenomenon. In fact, if you look at the UK, well, it's even more pronounced. So every single time there's a recession, you get the UK losing millions of manufacturing jobs. And after the recession ends, it just levels off. You haven't seen a recovery in manufacturing in the UK in at least the last 40 years. And in the space from the end of the credit crisis, or really the sovereign wealth crisis, 2009, manufacturing jobs in the UK have added on approximately 100,000 jobs. But during the recessions, you generally tend to lose about 1 million jobs. Well, what that says is that when we get the next recession, there is a strong likelihood that there simply won't be a manufacturing sector in the UK. And when we think about the manufacturing sector in the UK, well, the really high-paying jobs are in the aeronautics sector and in the car manufacturing sectors. And then you have the people that are working at making fish fingers in Grimsby. So those are all considered to be manufacturing jobs, but obviously some of them pay substantially more than others. The loss of any manufacturing jobs, though, represents a further increase in inequality. And that's a very significant medium to longer term issue, because when we think about capitalism, capitalism trends towards consolidation. It encourages competition, but eventually what you generally get is that bigger companies tend to take over the smaller companies. Those that fail to innovate either go out of business, and then their assets are divided up and devoured by their stronger competitors. But by and large, what it contributes to is consolidation. I think we have some great examples of that just in the last few months, where, for example, DuPont and Dow Chemical have merged. That creates a behemoth in terms of the chemicals industry. Saudi Aramco is acquiring at its neighboring chemical company. So that's going to create a energy slash chemical behemoth. When, for example, we look at Disney, well, Disney has acquired Marvel, it's acquired Star Wars, and then it acquired Fox. So that has contributed to the share going sideways with an upward bias over the course of the last 4 years. But what we now see is that this is an entertainment behemoth. So what we have plenty of evidence of right now is that there is continued trending towards consolidation. And that is likely to continue to represent a bullish characteristic for stock markets. So that's a really clear trend. But we have to anticipate that eventually it will end. generally speaking, if we go back and look at monopolies over history, then antitrust has been a factor. But antitrust, in fact, if you look at the results of antitrust and you start to tot together the resulting companies after a big conglomerate breakup, that if you add together the fates of each of the subsequent companies, they generally tend to outperform the original parent because it introduces competition. And so, therefore, while initially jarring, there is the potential for antitrust to, in fact, produce positive outcomes for shareholders, not least because when the big shareholdings in the big company are split up, you end up with a share of all the resulting companies as well. But the problem is that when we look out to the potential, that inequality in democracies leads to electoral change. Inequality in a very tightly controlled autocracies leads to revolution. So that's a very significant difference. That's also one of the reasons why a lot of dictatorial type of or autocratic societies tend to look very, very strong until it eventually breaks, and the breaking of the system exhibits just how shallow and fragile it is, and how dependent often on the personality of the person right at the top, the system is. The fact that the leader of Algeria has been in that position for the last 40 odd years, and it is only his declining health has resulted in street protests calling for his ouster, is another just very recent example of that exact same trend. We have to consider potentially that we're going to get an increasing number of left-wing populists. That's particularly a risk in the UK and in the USA. So those are two regions that we need to pay particular attention to. One thing that I think is really quite important to really think about is governance. It is too easy to simply think about governance is everything in emerging markets. It is very easy to throw the critical eye onto somebody else. It is much more difficult to turn the critical eye inwards. For example, the college cheating scam in the USA. Well, that is, on the one hand, the fact that it was outed and that we are now getting due process in the courts is certainly positive. That's the good side. The bad side is that this system succeeded in counterfeiting in the college admittance process for decades before it became a really big issue. And that gets to the heart of the question about meritocracy. What is obviously one of the most abiding traits of global capitalism is that people who have the intelligence and the work ethic and a little bit of luck can do very well from life and therefore are net contributors to global and local productivity and help to raise the well-being of everyone around them. But the clear bias then is to give those people more credit than they're due. And for the obviously, there is an argument that, well, if people aren't successful, is it really their fault? Well, in a meritocratic society, then there is a clear argument that yes, it is their fault because they're not willing to work hard enough, or they because everyone was given the same advantages. When you start to see governance deteriorating and inequality rising, and rising inequality is a source of instability, and it's as a result of deteriorating standards of governance. Therefore, we have to conclude that the standards of governance are declining where we have an uptick in political populism. But unfortunately, when we look around the world, the tide of political populism is rising everywhere. And I think that is one of the most important conclusions that we can come to, that when we think about is governance improving or deteriorating, well, it was very easy to conclude that governance was improving from approximately the 2000 onwards. But we've had a number of crashes since then, and we've had quantitative easing. And the total of money that has been pumped into the global markets is rather extraordinary. And if we simply just take the balance sheets of the major central banks, which are the Federal Reserve, the Bank of Japan, the People's Bank of China, and the ECB, then what we're presented with is this massive trend of accumulation since 2008. And the total for just those four central banks is currently around at 19.87 trillion. One of the most important facts is that that total has been contracting. We had a very substantial rebound in November and December, despite the fact that there is an increasing willingness among investors to price in the potential that we are moving into an additional round of quantitative easing, not just from one central bank, but an increasing number. The total has been contracting this year. Part of the reason that it has been contracting is because of the relative strength of the dollar. When we redenominate all of those central bank balance sheets into US dollars, then if the dollar goes up, their relative value deteriorates, and that is contributing to less liquidity flowing into the global economy. Well, one thing that we have definitely seen recently is that the Chinese market has been doing really very well, and it was up rather impressively over the course of the last few days. I'm just going to make sure that this chart is updated so that we get a proper picture of exactly what has happened. And when we look at this chart over the course of just about 30 years, well, what we're presented with is a very choppy environment. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that the Chinese market is prone to bubbles. And we've had one big example of that in 2005 through to 2007, and we had a minor example of that in 2014 and 15. And now we're getting another sharp rebound. Well, the reason we're getting another sharp rebound is because at the party congress that concluded a couple of weeks ago, the Chinese administration came out and said that they're looking for the banking sector to start to extend credit and to support the private enterprise sector of the Chinese economy. Well, that is essentially a green light for additional monetary and fiscal stimulus from China. And one thing that has been abundantly clear in terms of manufacturing is that a lot of people did not come back to the coastal cities following the New Year holiday. So some factories have moved inland, but the Chinese manufacturing sector is in trouble because these factories have seen the availability of credit evaporate, and that has created a much more difficult trading environment for them. So the turn now to increasing liquidity provision is obviously very positive from the perspective of both stimulus for the Chinese economy, demand for everything that helps to stimulate growth in the Chinese economy, and also the global economy by extension. So when we look at what the potential sources of new liquidity are, then China is a very significant source of additional liquidity. There is, of course, the additional point that the Chinese stock market is rallying in a very persistent manner right now because people are willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the potential that the trade war is in fact over. I think the fact that the banking sector in China is also now returning to outperformance is also a clear indication that we are at a point where liquidity is starting to flow once more in China. Then we have the fact that the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index is at new all-time highs. And I think that's one of the most significant factors. It's, I think, even more impressive if we look at it on a candlestick chart. Going all the way back to 1999, 2000, we had a very clear acceleration, and there was a clear acceleration too in 2016 and 17. We went through this very deep process of consolidation back in the period from October to December, and that had very clear top formation characteristics. The subsequent rebound has been really incredible in terms of the speed and aggression with which markets have rallied in the intervening 3 months since the low in December. So this is a very clear bet that we are back on a recovery footing for or what I've been describing as a reflation trade in terms of the global economy. It's that is first and foremost being driven by China. The fact is that China does not produce its own semiconductors, and the potential clearly then is that if China is starting to boom again, then that will create demand for semiconductors, and that's obviously positive for some of these companies. What's rather interesting, though, is that it is the US companies are doing best. They are clearly pricing in the potential that we are going to see a positive outcome to the trade negotiations. Well, one thing that I think we have to be prepared for in the short term is that there is a certain amount of buy the rumor and potentially sell the news going on in terms of this price appreciation. So I think that's a rather significant factor. There is the additional point, though, that semiconductors are generally cyclical, and they are quite heavily leveraged to the growth of the global economy. The fact that China is stimulating once more, and the fact that these are breaking upwards once more, suggests that the global reflation trade is real. Then, when we look at the performance of mining shares, well, the FTSE 350 mining index has now cleared the 20,000 level. We've had a bit of back and forth action this week, but it is closing out the week at new recovery highs, and it hasn't sustained a move above the 20,000 level in as convincing a manner in at least the last 6.5 to 7 years. So that's, I think, something that rather stands out. And we have a very similar condition on the resources sector in Australia. And of course, commodities generally are really rather cyclical. So when we look at, for example, the iron ore price, it's been ranging more or less below $80 since 2017, but that was a failed upside break, so since 2014, and now it is starting to move higher once more. The copper price has been putting in a first step above its little base over the course of the last few weeks. Nickel prices have been rather stable and are also putting in a range above the trend mean. Platinum prices this week pushed above. Oops, didn't type that particularly effectively. Platinum prices are right in the region of $900 and have been able to break up and out of the range that was put in over the course of the last 6 months. So we are starting to see some return to interest for the commodity complex. It's not 100% I think supported by commonality just yet because a number of the soft commodities are still quite weak. But oil prices were up an additional dollar in here today. And that is now pulling away from the most recent one of those ranges. Each one of the little ranges that has been put in has resulted in a rally of about $5 from the upper side of the underlying range. Well, what that suggests is that if this is going to remain consistent, we're probably going to see the next area of resistance around $72.50. And as long as it doesn't pull back by more than 7, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And of course, that is also consistent with a global reflation trade, because if the global economy is starting to pick up pace again, then that should be beneficial to oil demand. Natural gas prices, on the other hand, have been really quite weak and are right back down on the lower side of their range. What we are definitely starting to see now is a global market evolving for LNG, but we have such a short-term oversold condition now in the UK natural gas markets that we had an upside key reversal on Wednesday, follow through on Thursday, and then very clear breaking of the downtrend in here today. So that's clear evidence that some stops were hit and that a reversionary rally is now underway in UK gas. And it has ample potential to rebound in here. And but the much bigger picture is that natural gas has historically been a byproduct of oil and a very local market, and that the only way to get it around was by pipelines. That is now changing, so that the USA, it has got so much oil and so much gas that natural gas prices in Texas went negative this week. And that is a true testament to just how much supply they've got. The USA is now producing more than 12 million barrels of oil a day. The fact is that they are still importing oil because a lot of the refining capacity that the USA has is for heavy oil. And the kind of oil that unconventional supply is producing is Bonnie Light Sweet. So it's very low in sulfur and isn't really compatible with a lot of the refining capacity on the Gulf Coast. Despite the fact that Texas tea was the original source of oil that came from the Texas fields, Texas doesn't have a great deal of capacity to refine it. Well, that suggests that the US is going to be importing oil for a little while yet. But supply continues to expand. The IEA anticipates that Texas in particular and the USA generally have 4 million barrels of oil that could be drilled and brought to market over the course of the next 5 years. And that has the scope to completely upend the global oil market. A lot of the oil that is being produced is from private enterprise, and private enterprises have got a profit incentive. It's not they obviously want to project an image of an environmental sensitivity, but the large state-owned oil companies have got a responsibility to hand over royalties and tax to their national governments, and because these national governments use their natural resource companies as piggy banks for vanity projects and stipends for connected individuals, they tend to be less efficient. That was abundantly clear this week in terms of the bond filing for Saudi Aramco, where it's the most profitable company in the world, but At the same time, it is not producing oil nearly as efficiently as some of the large privately held companies like Exxon or Chevron. So that's a further testament to the fact that private enterprise does produce greater efficiencies, not least because of competitive forces and responsibility to shareholders. The fact that the USA has got this massive bonus in terms of energy independence and the ability to become the swing producer in terms of global exports, that's a very significant benefit to the economy. It's something that I just have not seen other people talking about. When we listen to people like Ray Dalio or Jeff Gundlach or Howard Marks, they're very concerned about the social implications of populism and have a great deal of sympathy with a number of the arguments that they make. But they don't pay much attention to the fact that the balance of payments that the USA has is going to improve remarkably over the course of the next few years as energy exports ramp up. And that's a very significant bonus for the US economy. It's also one of the clear reasons why the US dollar has been firm. It's not simply because of the fact that the USA has got a higher interest rate, or that the US economy is continuing to expand, or that hiring and unemployment are at new all-time lows, but it's also because the USA is now energy independent, and it is going to have to send a lot fewer dollars overseas in return for oil exports over the course of the next decades. And that's a powerfully bullish factor. When we look at the broad dollar index, then, and particularly over the long term, it's been ranging in the region of the peak from back in 2000 for much of the last 3 years. And it was a little softer the last time it was updated back at the end of March. But there is the potential that the US dollar is going to break higher. And if that's the case, then that's going to continue to attract additional dollars into the US economy. It will create a further dearth of liquidity internationally. That will put even greater pressure on the global economies that compete with the USA to devalue their currencies and to increase support for their respective economies. That's already what we're starting to see with the Chinese stimulus, the fact that the ECB has only just ended its quantitative easing program and is really now back on the cusp of starting to reignite it again. It also, I think, something that again people don't tend to talk about is that we have a really great example from the ECB in what happens when a central bank tries to remove liquidity from the system. Well, the ECB took €1 trillion out of circulation, and they subsequently had to add back in 2.6 trillion. So it represented a 160% increase on the original figure. Well, if we think about that in terms of the USA central bank, they anticipate moderating the pace with which they are reducing the size of the balance sheet from May and ending it back or out in September. Well, that's going to take it to, let's say, for example, 3.75 in terms of the size of the balance sheet. Well, if you multiply that by 1.6, and I'm just doing that on my calculator, you get to 6 trillion. Well, 6 trillion would represent a very significant stimulus, and it is quite possible that the next time we do have an economic contraction, that the response from central banks will be to cut interest rates aggressively, go down to zero, potentially less than zero, and to flood the market with liquidity, adding in an additional more than, well, approximately $2 trillion in support. And that's really just a start, because that's really only telling us what Europe has done so far to get back to even after the depression they almost caused by removing a trillion from circulation. The ECB is not yet finished. What that suggests is we're going to get a lot more liquidity provision coming. And that is what the stock market is pricing in. That is why the stock market has been rallying so aggressively over the course of the last 3 months. The Nasdaq was in additional positive territory in here today, and that is really a testament to the subscription business model. If we look at the cyclical parts of the global market, then biotechnology was also in positive territory in here today. There is a very clear argument for why companies like Illumina and some of the immuno-oncology companies should be doing better. They are at the absolute forefront of the technological frontier in terms of the evolution of technology to better people's lives. If we think about the fact that the unconventional oil and gas bull market has completely upended the global geopolitical situation, it is going to transform the US economy's balance of payments and reduce costs for consumers. That represents a very significant tailwind. When we look at the Dow gold ratio, we can see, for example, that if we look at the very, very long term, and when we really think about this in terms of cyclical and secular bull markets, we know that secular bull markets on Wall Street last a long time. They go on for much longer than anyone ever really thought possible. They go on for so long that they change the fundamentals of the market. And they go on for so long that people start to really believe that they can never end. And we are nowhere near that today. In fact, if anything, people think that this secular bull market is going to end any day now. I'm certainly on among the people that think that we're probably coming closer to a recession, and that there could quite likely be a recession in 2020, potentially because of populist left-wing populist candidates, very much from the mold of tax a lot and spend even more, coming to power. One of the clear conclusions that Ray Dalio is coming to in his missive was that there is going to have to be cooperation between monetary and fiscal stimulus. That is tantamount to modern monetary theory. What I've been, I think, rather clear about, and I think this is not simply inevitable, but it's actually already happening, that we have got evidence already that it isn't simply that modern monetary theory is in the future, it's that we've got it already. That the central bank has been in the, or let's talk about the Federal Reserve, saw the massive fiscal stimulus and started to raise rates, and that balanced out the economy. It started acting as a headwind last year, so now they have started to ease up again. Just as the fiscal impetus has started to come out of the market. Well, we have to consider that if growth starts to turn back down, then they will cut interest rates aggressively and engage in quantitative easing. If growth turns down, then it's quite likely we're going to have an infrastructure bill, or there's going to be an additional source of liquidity coming into the market that is going to inflate the quantity of debt. But you're unlikely to have a very clear rebellion among bond investors unless we start to see inflation picking up in an aggressive manner. And inflation, at least in the way that investors measure it, is not really picking up. When we look at, and I will make the additional point about the Dow gold ratio, that there are about 35 years between the peaks, and the last peak was in 1999. So that's a significant factor. And that each of the peaks is higher than the last, which suggests that this secular bull market in equities is going to be larger than the bull market we had in the 1980s and 1990s. That's a very significant forecast, and it also suggests that we're not really yet halfway through it. So that's an additional potential here, that there is scope for this market to continue to rally for another 15 years, potentially. And we also have an additional correlation that is worth considering, and it is that when we look at oil prices, not simply over days or weeks, but over decades, then we get this cyclicality. We get these very long ranges, which are in tune with the long term, and then our secular bears, and then we get these decade-long bull markets. So we have had a decade-long bull market. It has delivered a lot of additional new supply, and it is probably going to take upwards of another 15 years to work through that additional supply. So that, I think, is a very significant potential outcome. And it also gels rather well with the Dow gold ratio, that long ranges in oil prices contribute to economic growth, which is supportive of equities and boosts growth in the economy. So that's a clear conclusion that we can draw from the massive innovation that has already occurred and continues to drive the energy markets. But secular bull markets are not just driven by energy, they're also driven by technology. And technological innovation is accelerating. And that's particularly the case in the biotech sector. I'll give you a personal example, which I think was something that we found to be incredibly useful. Mrs. Tracy suffered from pancreatitis in her first and second pregnancies, and she suffered from hyperlipidemia, which means that the blood samples were breaking or were coming back as unfulfillable from the testing facility because her blood was separating like oil and water between hemoglobin and fat in the vials. They had to recalibrate the machinery to come up with a value. And we never knew what the answer for that was and why it was happening. And the primary causes for pancreatitis are drinking and being obese or diabetes, and she had none of those things. We went to a number of doctors and really did not get a conclusive answer. We signed up with Human Longevity Inc. back in January. They took her down to San Diego, or really La Jolla. They gave her a full body scan. They looked at everything from a full body MRI to an EKG to a CAT scan, and they came back and told her that she was very healthy, but that she had lesions, or not lesions, she had growths, let's put it that way, on her liver, near her gallbladder, and that when they became inflamed, they were causing pancreatitis, and because they were cutting off access to the bile ducts. And that is the only way we could possibly have got a diagnosis. Then they also did the full genetic testing of the genome and the phenome, and came back with a full list of popular drugs and what kind of sensitivity she has to drugs, because she's often reported having a very strong physical reaction to even the mildest form of ibuprofen. So that again was impossible until approximately the last 3 or 4 years. What that is going to eventually do, well, it's not eventually, it has already been inputted into her medical records. It means that whenever she goes for an additional medical treatment, that they will consult her genetic profile. They will know exactly how sensitive she is to dosages and how her body reacts to them due to her genetic profile. And that will help to deliver better health outcomes in future. Well, this is the kind of diagnostic treatment that was impossible before. It's likely to contribute to much better health outcomes in future. And the cost of delivering this kind of treatment is collapsing. It's already down 60% from the last few years. Well, when we think about the fact that Illumina has got machines in the market today that they anticipate that by the time they get to the end of the product cycle, people will be sequencing the genome for less than $100. What that is going to create is a services industry where the services provided are going to expand because the cost of providing them will decrease, and it will be the interpretation of the results is what you will pay for. It also means that constant monitoring is going to become a very easy thing to do. And that is something that can contribute to better health outcomes. If more people live longer, healthier lives, it removes some of the pressure that comes to bear on the health sector, and it makes the general population more productive. Well, that's obviously to be welcomed, and it is something that can help to drive a secular bull market. Well, when we think about governance, the things that we have to, that are most precious in terms of governance, are that there is respect for minority shareholder interests. Because, and then if you have that, you need to have an independent judiciary, so that if you are wronged, you have recourse to the courts to get justice. You need to have a free press, so that if the courts are corrupt, then they can be outed in the media. If you have those three things, then it is preservation of those three characteristics that becomes the most important maintenance fact in terms of support for global governance. And the fact that governments were willing to sacrifice millions of jobs by allowing China into the WTO and supporting globalization on a massive scale in the, I think when it was sold to their domestic populations, it was that we need to help all the poor people of the world achieve a better life. And that has been achieved. Poverty rates internationally have been trending downwards. The success of emerging markets in lifting hundreds and literally billions of people out of abject poverty and into the middle classes has been achieved, and it has created a condition where the emerging markets now represent a very significant part of the global economy. But What was not mentioned was that it was going to represent the loss of millions of jobs from Europe and North America. And the reason that we haven't really felt it until quite recently has been because of debt accumulation. And that's a very significant issue, because it isn't simply that yields have been contracting, but that the quantity of debt has been increasing. That virtually ensures that we're getting modern monetary theory being implemented on a more increasing basis, because it's very hard for the central bank to raise interest rates when that is going to have a massively deleterious effect on the government's finances. That suggests that the failed break above 3% and the subsequent move back below 2.5% is a potentially, at least, an extension of the base formation. And if that's the case, the fact that we've had this reversionary move in the yields and that we're starting to see some of the impetus coming back into the bond rally, well, that suggests that there is a clear bet in the bond markets that we are moving back towards a neutral, if not more accommodative, interest rate environment. I think we're well past the conclusion that we are at the top of the interest rate cycle. The bond markets are already pricing in progressively more interest rate cuts. So how is it that the bond markets have priced in an interest rate cut already, and yet stock markets internationally are resurgent? And the S&P 500 was again in positive territory this week. It is closing in on the 2900 point level. That is pretty much coinciding with the peaks put in back in September and October. The banking sector in the US has been struggling to do better, but it was in positive territory in here this week. It's now right in the region of the trend mean. The question is whether it can move above this level. If we get yields contracting further, I would suspect that the answer to that question is no. What the banking sector and interest rate sensitive sectors like banks are telling us, in addition to what the banks, the bond market is telling us, and the stock market is telling us, is the only kinds of condition where bonds and equities can rally together is quantitative easing. What that suggests is that the market has concluded we are moving back into a quantitative easing scenario. And then when we look at what's going on in terms of the pound has stabilized around 130 over the course of the last month, and it is right in the region of the trend mean. There is obviously uncertainty ahead of the potential exit of the UK from the EU on the 15th. I continue to think that it is much more likely that the result of the Brexit vote is going to be betrayed, and that if the UK leaves, it is going to leave in name only, and that there is a fighting chance that they're not going to leave at all. And that suggests that the last thing that politicians want is another election, because there is going to be a revolt by voters in terms of their dissatisfaction with what they have in fact been provided in terms of leadership and governance in the economy. So there is, though, the potential that the FTSE 250 is going to hold at this level, that the uncertainty with regard to the Brexit question and the fact that it is probably going to create problems in the medium term, but potentially a bullish phenomena in the short term, suggests that the FTSE 250 could do better, and so could the pound in the short term, but it's going to obviously create a very big question at the next election. That's why the UK is one of the countries that is at most at risk of a left-wing populist revolution. So I think when we think about the outlook for markets, I think it is worth considering that we are in the third psychological perception stage of this medium-term bull. We're really only halfway through the secular bull market. Well, what that suggests is that the next recession is going to provide some incredible buying opportunities from the perspective of a long-term investor. It also means that now is the time to pay particular attention to the consistency of trends, because of the risks from inequality that and the rise of populism, and the fact that central banks have are on the cusp of missing the point in terms of how quickly they need to lower interest rates. Well, that suggests, particularly with the rise of populism, that 2020 is going to be a difficult year in terms of the election process. But when we think about the presidential cycle, it's generally in the first half of the third year that we get a wobble in the stock market. And it might be tempting to think that the wobble we got between October and December was it, but it would be rather early. So what I think that starts to suggest is that we've had a very impressive rally over the course of the last 4 months. We have a number of indices at potential areas of resistance, and it wouldn't be at all surprising if we get some consolidation and potentially a little scare in the first half of the year before things start to improve in the latter half of the summer, and potentially push us on to new high ground by the end of the year. That's, of course, assuming that the US presidential cycle is still efficacious. Then, when we think about the outlook for a recession, there was an awful lot of commentary last year, excuse me, last week, about the inverted yield curve. But the 2 and 10 spread, which is what the vast majority of bond investors look at, has not yet inverted. It's only the inversion between the very short end of the curve and the longer end of the curve, which has been making headlines. That inversion tends to have a much longer lead time, and that suggests that we are still not yet on the cusp of a recession. That if we are in the third psychological perception stage, we have to conclude that there is a fighting chance that this bull market, the medium-term advance, is going to climax with an acceleration before the recession in fact hits. And I think that is gaining increasing likelihood, considering the rebound that we have seen in some of the very largest companies in the world. I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend. I'll wish all the best to all of you.